Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, sending humans to Mars, the June solstice, werewolf syndrome, and how cities play a major role in climate change. Here's a scientist soundbite.
The most important thing that people need to know about human exploration of the planet Mars is that it's within our capability of doing it, and that if we do it, we will find out fundamental truths about the nature of life on Earth and throughout the universe, and we'll open up a new path to a wide-open human future without limits.
You're listening to Robert Zubrin. He's president and founder of the Mars Society, with more than 4,000 members that promote the human exploration and settlement of our neighboring planet, Mars. EarthSky asked Dr. Zubrin, why go to Mars?
Well, there's really three reasons, for the science, for the challenge, and for the future. As far as the science is concerned, Mars is the planet that is closest to us that could have supported life in the past and may still do so in the present. And so by going to Mars and exploring those dried up lakes and river valleys and drilling into the subsurface groundwater on Mars, looking for fossils, looking for microbial life that may yet persist, we'll be able to determine if life is a general phenomenon in the universe or is a phenomenon unique to the Earth. We'll discover if we're alone or not, because we now know that planets are plentiful in the galaxy, and if life evolves commonly wherever there is a planet with reasonable conditions, and any star has reasonable conditions at an appropriate distance, then life is common, and since the entire history of life on Earth is one of development from simpler forms to more complex forms, displaying greater capacities for activity and intelligence and ever more rapid evolution, if life is everywhere, it means intelligence is everywhere. It means we're not alone. This is something that thinking men and women have wondered about for thousands of years. It's worth going there to find out. The second reason is the challenge. I think that civilizations are like individuals. We grow when we're challenged. We stagnate when we're not. And a Humans to Mars program would be an embracing challenge for our society, particularly for our youth. It would say to every young person, learn your science and you can be an explorer or pioneer of new worlds. And out of that challenge, we get millions of scientists, engineers, inventors, doctors, medical researchers, technological entrepreneurs. These are the kinds of people that drive society forward. You might view it as a tremendously powerful investment in intellectual capital. And then finally, for the future, the Earth is not the only world. And if we go to Mars, we're beginning humanity's career as a multi-planet spacefaring species. And, and if we do this, then 500 years from now, there will be new branches of human civilization on Mars, and I believe on many worlds beyond. And when those people look back at our time, what will they consider of what we are doing today to be significant? What we did to make their civilization possible, okay? New worlds, new countries, new nations with new languages and new histories. That's what's important. So this is really the most important thing that our age will be remembered for.
We have more with Robert Zubrin at EarthSky.org. EarthSky is a clear voice for science. We're EarthSky, heard on 1,200 stations around the world, including Voice of America. Deborah Bird joins us now to talk about the global night sky and the solstice this month of June. Hello, Deborah.
Hello, Jorge. Yes, the June solstice, it's the most wonderful solstice for us in the Northern Hemisphere because it's our summer solstice. For those in the Southern Hemisphere, it's the winter solstice, and it comes at 1716 UTC, that's 5:16 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, 12:16 p.m. Central Daylight Time here in the U.S. on June 21st.
What's the significance of that moment, the solstice moment?
Well, Earth is orbiting around the sun, and Earth is tilted by 23.5 degrees on its axis. So a solstice happens when we come to a place in our orbit that Earth's northern hemisphere, in this case, is most tilted toward the sun. So what that means is that the sun, as it appears in Earth's sky, reaches a point where it's at its most northerly point for the year. So for us in the northern hemisphere, that means that the sun is very high up. It's making a very high arc across the sky. For the southern hemisphere, on the other hand, it means that it's a low sun, a low winter sun, making a low arc across the winter sky, the northern sky, as seen from the southern hemisphere.
Right. So for northern hemisphere people, it means the beginning of summer. And down south in the southern hemisphere, it means the beginning of winter?
Well, you might not realize, Jorge, but there's no official world body that has decreed that the solstice marks the beginning of summer or winter. It's just tradition that we do that. But yes, it is tradition, and it's a tradition all over the earth. So happy summer.
Happy summer. And so tell us, I understand that you've researched what the solstice means in other cultures as well.
Well, the culture that I'm very familiar with is Chinese culture. And the Chinese were great students of nature. So they recognized natural cycles, and they correlated natural cycles to what they called the five elements or the five phases. And those five elements or five phases also correlate to the seasons. So the summer season in Chinese thought correlates to a whole bunch of things that are really kind of cool and kind of interesting.
I thought there were only four seasons.
Well, the Chinese include a fifth season, and that's sometimes considered to be sort of like what we call our Indian summer, the season between summer and fall. Or it's sometimes considered to be kind of like the center of a wheel. So different schools of Chinese thought consider that fifth season to be something different.
So, Deborah, the Chinese have a different way of thinking about summer. How do they think about it?
And well, again, and we're talking about traditional Chinese thought. So all of these five elements or five phases are correlated with a whole bunch of stuff. And the one that's correlated with summer is also connected to the color red, the direction south, the sound of laughing, an organ of the body, which is the heart, and the element fire. So if you were, you know, a student of ancient Chinese thought, you would think of all those things. You'd think of south, red, laughing, the heart organ, the element fire in connection with the season of summer. So that brings us to, you know, how folks out there listening can celebrate this solstice, and we can do it from both the Western and the Eastern perspective. And if you're in the Northern Hemisphere, you can notice that the morning dawn is coming very early now. These are the most beautiful dawns of the year, and that'll be happening definitely throughout the month of June. Of course, the sun is setting very late, so we have these very long, wonderful days. In the southern hemisphere, it's different. The days are very short. From an Eastern perspective, because the Chinese were such big believers in balance, you can take these various things that are correlated with the summer season and you can try to balance them. For example, the summer season is correlated with the fire element. So you could balance that by going swimming in a deep, dark pool. And the Chinese would have considered that a very healthy thing to do. Or you can just laugh, because laughter is associated with the summer season in Chinese thought. And so is the heart organ, which I think it's pretty cool now that we have this idea that laughter is good for the heart. And the ancient Chinese philosophers would have agreed with that.
The solstice is indeed celebrated throughout the world.
Yes, it is, Jorge. So happy solstice to you.
Happy solstice. Earth Sky's Deborah Bird, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. We'd love to hear from you on Facebook. Tell us where you're from. You can find us as Earth Sky. Ryan Britton, our chief weird science correspondent, brings us an update on hypertrichosis, otherwise known as werewolf syndrome. Welcome, Ryan.
Oh, it's good to be here.
So werewolf syndrome sounds a bit scary.
Yes, but it isn't. It's an extremely rare and weird syndrome. Hypertrichosis or werewolf syndrome is responsible for producing some of the hairiest people on Earth. People with this syndrome who are otherwise perfectly normal can literally have soft, thick hair covering their faces and bodies. It can look like fur. The earliest case of this syndrome was documented back in the 1600s, but scientists now think they know what causes this growth of hair, and it's a genetic mutation of the X chromosome.
You're talking about the part of our DNA that determines a person's gender?
Right, right. And keep in mind that there are less than 100 documented cases of hypertrichosis around the world right now, but it tends to run through families. So a professor mapped the genes of a family out in China and found an extra bit of genes in the X chromosome. Researchers then went and tested another family with the syndrome in Mexico, and they too had the same extra genetic material in their X chromosomes.
Ryan, what did the scientists find?
Well, they found that this extra DNA can turn on a hair growth gene nearby within the genetic material. And this hair growth gene, when it's turned on, basically creates hair all over the body. And identifying this gene, actually, it's kind of cool because it could help people with the syndrome not only maybe not be so hairy if they choose to be, or what's neat is that it could help millions of people with unwanted hair loss grow their hair back.
So this research on werewolf syndrome could help people losing their hair.
That's right. We could all have a big Hollywood coif. So we'll see more about what happens.
And where can people find out more about this recent hair discovery?
Folks can go to usnews.com, livescience.com. They both have some stories on this new discovery. And you can find the whole scientific article. It's available at cell.com. That's at cell.com/AJHG.
Weird Science with Ryan Britton. Thanks, Ryan.
Sure, you're welcome.
We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Earth Sky, heard on 1,200 stations around the world, including Voice of America. Beth Lebwohl is here with a report on cities and climate change. Hello, Beth.
Hey, Jorge. How you doing?
Doing great. So tell us about your interview with Cynthia Rosenzweig of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies.
Well, I spoke to Dr. Rosenzweig, who is absolutely delightful. She is a senior research scientist at NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, and she's also head of their Climate Impacts Group. But in addition to all that, she's co-editor of a new report called Climate Change in Cities. About 110 climate change experts contributed to the work, and it focuses on a couple of cities in particular, really big cities, let's say New York, Tokyo, Shanghai, Dakar. And the thesis is cities are on the front lines of climate change.
They are on the front lines, first, of impacts, because many cities are located along the coast. So greater flooding from sea level rise will affect cities all around the world. And also, cities already are warmer than other places because their buildings and lack of trees and vegetation make them into urban heat islands. So they're already hotter and are projected to get even hotter with climate change. Cities are also the place where a lot of economic activity goes on and a lot of transportation and a lot of buildings being kept warm and cool. So cities also are responsible for a lot of the greenhouse gas emissions that are the primary cause of climate change.
They are also what Rosenzweig calls climate change first responders. So they are somehow, in some ways, more organized than nations have been, you know, some nations at least, in terms of organizing their response to climate change. That is, one, adapting, and two, trying to mitigate it.
Let's listen to Dr. Rosenzweig talk about New York and climate change.
Let's start with my own home city, New York City. New York, on the adaptation side, has brought together about 40 different agencies that run the critical infrastructure of New York. That's the subways, the commuter rail lines, the water systems, even the telecoms that run all the cell phones that we're always talking on all the time, and created a climate change task force that looked at the risks of a changing climate, and then have brought forward across all those different types of infrastructure plans and ideas for how they can develop a climate resilient city. New York has also, through its sustainability plan, which is called Plan YC, have committed to a target of 30% reduction of greenhouse gases by 2030. So you can see that New York is doing both, working on the adaptation side and the mitigation side.
I thought that part was great, and I take a special pride in New York because I am a New Yorker by birth. But of course, you know, climate change is really, we're all in it together. And so there are developing nations that are coping, and nations that are not coastal cities that are also having to cope. So Dr. Rosenzweig explained to me about the expected impacts of climate change in Delhi, India, which is a huge non-coastal metropolis there.
Delhi is an inland city. But guess what? Even the cities that are not on the coast, all cities are on some kind of waterway, primarily rivers, inland. And rivers, as we certainly have seen in the United States very recently, are very prone to flooding. And the projections show with both, in many places, increases in precipitation and also increases in extreme precipitation events. We see in, for example, Delhi, that the a key vulnerability is the risk of riverine flooding, of river flooding. And again, we have a similar situation in Delhi. In some ways, there are similarities across cities, of course, that there are informal settlements there, often right along the riverbanks. And this is of, again, great concern. Now, Delhi has been, you asked for, you know, I know, you know, it's really important to show concrete examples of what cities are doing. So Delhi is very well known on the mitigation side, because they changed all their buses and taxis to compress natural gas from very, very dirty diesel-burning fuel. And they did it in large part for air pollution effects. But by switching to that cleaner fuel, not only did it help on the air quality, but it helped on the greenhouse gas emissions as well. So Delhi is certainly taking the lead, is one of the cities that is taking the lead on the mitigation side.
Okay, just for a point of clarification or a caveat, the jury isn't quite out on natural gas. So there are things that about natural gas use that are good, but there are things, there are ways in which it could be environmentally detrimental that we're just starting to understand. So I just wanted to point that out to you, our audience.
Well, yeah. So tell me, Beth, in this interview with Cynthia Rosenzweig about cities and climate change, what do you think is like the biggest thing that she wants people to know? Like, what's the takeaway message here?
I think the takeaway message for her, or at least the sense that I got, was twofold. First, that cities are taking the lead in action on climate change. That's a direct quote from Dr. Rosenzweig. She also emphasized to me that it's not just wealthy cities in developed countries that are having the real fantastic light bulb ideas about how to deal with climate change. It's also cities in developing nations with not as much money at their disposal, but a lot of creativity.
Great interview. Thanks, Beth.
Hey, thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Beth Lebwohl, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. that's our show. Thank you for joining us. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers, Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. Our audio engineer is Eddie Campos. And special thanks this week to our musical contributors, Okote Soul Sounds, Sleep Good, 100 Flowers, and the Black and White Years. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many artists, too much hype, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next age. But what we don't know won't hurt us. What we don't know won't keep us up at night. What we don't know won't hurt us. But what we don't know.